I'm Deanna Meyer with DGR. And
I'm Brian Ertz, Wildlands Defense.
And we're just here to talk about the prairie dog campaign that we just did about a large colony of prairie dogs here in Castle Rock. I was really concerned about it and was trying to figure out how to do something so that we could stop them from being killed. And so I was lucky enough to bump into Brian over here with Wildlands Defense, and we started just forming a very effective campaign that ended up really putting this whole situation in the spotlight and making some good opportunities for prairie dogs and prairie lands.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the background, about what the situation was that you were...
Yeah, so there was going to be a big, huge mega mall, still is. It's one of the, it was in an article, it was quoted as one of the nation's largest malls. I don't know if that was necessarily true, but it's pretty big, 166 acres of mall. And it was going over one of the largest prairie dog colonies in Colorado's front, on Colorado's Front Range that's left. So I was, and I watched them for a really long time and really loved that particular colony and wanted to see what we could do to help save the prairie dogs, get them relocated, and stop the destruction.
So what's your interest in prairie dogs?
I've always really loved prairie dogs and any kind of life, but that was one of the colony. I've seen so many colonies just die. Here in Colorado, they're just like exterminating all of them. Most of them have been gone. So before I noticed, I had watched a large prairie dog colony for years, even knew about it when I was younger. And I saw one day it was there, everybody's happy, babies are running around. The next day I came out there and the whole thing was totally gone, every single prairie dog gone. And so I got really worried about this particular site because it was the next largest colony that I had seen. So I called the town and found out that it was indeed going to be, a huge construction was going on top of it. And that was about a year or a little, about 8 months before I got real involved because they told me that nothing was going to happen on that site until at least 2016. And then in November, that article came out about how the nation's greatest mall just got approved.
So what would you say to people who said that prairie dogs are just pests and there's no big loss in them?
Well, prairie dogs are a keystone species, and they hold all the prairies together. And they're extremely important to the land. Well, and they, you know, 200 species depending on them and more. That's just mammals. And they form a very huge ecological importance on the landscape, and they're at less than 1% now of their habitats left. So they're in a lot of danger.
So how did this first play out? I understand it started around January of this year?
Yeah, in November I was that's when I saw the article about this mall, and then I started talking with other activists and Derek Jensen, really concerned about the whole prairie dog colony and what I could do, and we were just kind of scrambling, didn't think that we'd have much leverage at all, and that we did not think that we were going to be able to save them, but we were trying to get as many people as we could involved, like Wild Earth Guardians and Prairie Dog Coalition, which is with the Humane Society, or it's an arm of that. And several different people, Nicole Roth Marino, Southern Plains Land Trust, and nobody was any help at all until Brian called me because he had heard that there was an issue. So he called and said he thought he could help. And so we just started moving forward from there.
So what was the developer's reaction when you first asked them to help you relocate the prairie dogs?
He said he tried all that he could and couldn't find any land to put them on. And that he needed to move them immediately, and that he went and looked at the whole land and thought about it and said that he might give us about 5 acres of drainage land to put 166 acres of prairie dogs on, which of course we couldn't do, so maybe we could have saved 100 is what is the option, but not even that because the land was completely unsuitable. So he was entirely not willing to postpone or do anything to help with the prairie dogs, he said.
And was timing an issue with respect to relocation?
For him, yeah.
And how about for the prairie dogs?
Well, yeah, the prairie dogs needed to wait till June because they have their babies. They were all pregnant. They all had their burrows. They already had nests and everything to have their babies. And if you move that time of year in January and February, which was the time that we would have been able to, and we wouldn't really, it's hard for a lot of reasons. The holes are frozen, it's cold, the prairie dogs are pregnant, and it's not biologically viable time to move them. You really need to wait till June or the summer. June and, you know, throughout the summer and fall you can move them, but not really beyond then.
And you told the developer that?
Yeah.
And what was their reaction?
He said that he wasn't, you know, progress is progress. Can't stop progress. Okay. So he was not going to entertain that at all.
So what would you do next?
Well, this is when Brian started getting involved. And he was just, I wrote an article about the prairie dogs and came from a very emotional spot, you know, about what it was about the prairie dogs that I loved and why they were important and what they wanted to do with them, which I figured they were just going to bury them alive. And a lot of people, we published it with a DGR page, and a lot of people got really interested in it, and it got published in other places, Wildlife News. And then we just started going from there, doing a petition. So we put up a petition. The main purpose of that was just to formulate a long list of emails of people who were concerned and start to get locals involved in the whole process so that they could help, you know, bring light and publicity to this whole issue. Then we just started fundraisers, started getting a bunch of money, Facebook pages, the Facebook page Save the Castrock Mall Prairie Dog, started that, and then just started really hitting the whole media, social media, created a website, and started getting the word out that way, and putting pressure on the developers through public opinion and showing up at all the town council meetings.
So, Brian, why did you decide to get involved?
Well, it's what I do, and it was a unique circumstance in that there was an imminent threat to the prairie dogs, and there were a number of things that could be done that weren't being done, and so I got a phone call and somebody asked for help. That's what we do with our members, is if there's a wildlife or a landscape issue, we give an initial assessment as to what can be done and then decide whether or not it fits with our mission. So this did. And primarily, when I get calls from members or others, typically they just want us to deal with it. Whereas with Deanna, she was really willing to do the things necessary to make it effective. And so that's one of the things that really helps with respect to if you're going to put your own time into something, it's good to know that the people on the ground are going to be helping as well and carrying the water. So that's why Wildlands Defense got involved.
Okay.
What were some of the things that you identified initially that could be done that weren't being done yet?
Well, the publication, so galvanizing media, for example. So online, prairie dogs are a very charismatic species. Illustrating that fact and putting out some feelers as far as public support. Making a call to the developer, assessing the regulatory framework or the laws that exist in the municipality and whether or not there'd be any hooks or any leverage from that perspective, and then engaging the conversation as far as the economic interest, the developer in this case, really giving them an opportunity to do the right thing and giving them a choice with respect to how wildlife advocates would pursue the situation. So all of those things, a basic assessment of the landscape and of how it was going to unfold, putting your finger up in the air and seeing where the wind is going with respect to things. And there were a lot of opportunities for pressure me to mount, to make it a compelling case to do the right thing in this circumstance. And not, you know, so that's why I, other people weren't doing it. Other groups weren't doing it. And we called the other groups to see their willingness to help out. We're in Idaho. There are plenty of wildlife groups in Colorado. And once we assessed that and, you know, threw out some ideas as far as bringing pressure, one of the things that economic interests, particularly retails, are very involved in is advertising, right, or marketing. That's a value that they have, they need to have. And so that's it's a vulnerability that you can use to compel them to do the right thing is, you know, here's the carrot, here's the stick. If you do the right thing, you're going to be, that's valuable to your enterprise. If you don't do the right thing, you know, we can make it a liability. And so assessing that, and then, you know, obviously you have to build credibility. The mall developer didn't really consider us to be that credible with respect to, it hasn't really happened before a lot. And so really showing up and demonstrating that with the media and then turning that into any number of other turns through the campaign as it happened.
So, Dan, you alluded to a referendum that this group kind of spearheaded. Was there anything else involved in terms of activities that the group undertook to indicate some resistance to the development?
I think there are so many different things that we've done to do that. I mean, just like we were working with a lawyer and presented and had litigation. We were really involved in the town council meetings because they did have a zoning issue that was still up. So we had that leverage to push on that and to get people in there and talking, which was incredible, the testimonies. Just that Fox News all came together. They were really interested in the story, and people were really interested in it. And we worked really hard with email lists to really get people, you know, to advocate for the story to be covered. I was lucky, too, because Fox News wanted to do the story initially. One of the newscasters who has been with us the whole time. So she was willing to come out pretty early in the game and do just a quick story on what was happening out there at the promenade and why the prairie dog colony was so, you know, big. And it was a good story, saying like the nation's biggest mall and one of the largest, you know, prairie dog colonies that were left intact. So it was an interesting story for people to cover because most people generally don't want a mega mall on top of a huge colony of prairie dogs. There's a lot of people in Colorado still that like wildlife quite a bit. So, I mean, just things came together in all different kinds of ways. And the referendum went down, was further down the line as more happened and the developers refused to listen to us. The town council refused to listen to us and they just kind of gave the thumbs up for them to continue with development. So that's when Brian and Karen presented the litigation, got that all together. And then we decided to do the referendum since they approved the mall going forward and they weren't going to slow down or postpone development until we get the prairie dogs out. So we decided to go ahead and get the citizens involved in that process, put that up for a vote. And I mean, I think there were so many different things in the campaign that were involved. And I think that it really started with like the media and the publicity and then him in Wildlands Defense getting all these other things and me getting all these other things in order so that we had all tactics on board really.
So is there any on the ground work that, took place as a result of this?
Oh yeah, we were doing protests and we were getting everybody involved in Castle Rock and in the local area that were concerned about the prairie dogs. People were doing 24-hour watches at the site because we were afraid they were going to poison them at any time and we knew they needed to because they were supposed to get everything killed according to the Colorado Parks and Wildlife and the biologist, the ERO, said the recommendation was to kill all the prairie dogs before March 15th because then that would get them out of the migratory bird issue. So they wouldn't have to worry about the burrowing owls or any other birds that came in there. So, and I guess that's a typical thing.
Could you explain that one?
Well, when you want to go ahead and say it and explain it better? I mean,
so what you're dealing with when you confront a campaign is where are the regulations that are going to jar up whatever a given interest wants to do with respect to grabbing hold of leverage to negotiate in the future toward what you want. In this instance, there were any number of layers of regulations or environmental laws which protect wildlife values. There's the Migratory Bird and Treaty Act, which is a federal law which provides that it's unlawful to kill migrating birds. And so any activities associated with the development that were likely to kill migratory birds are subject to a certain degree of scrutiny and regulation. Prairie dogs live in burrows and networks of burrows. The burrowing owl is an owl which migrates through Colorado and utilizes those burrows that prairie dogs make as its habitat, and it's necessary for their survival. The burrowing owl is state listed as threatened in the state of Colorado. So that's another, because of the ecological relationship, them being necessary for each other's survival, or at least burrowing owls depending upon prairie dog burrows for their survival as they migrate through Colorado. Destroying burrows is destroying burrowing owl habitat, and that's regulated, and it's very vague in the state of Colorado as to the enforceability of that regulation. There's also, you know, Preble's jumping mouse. There's other things where, as these different species overlap or depend on the same or similar habitats or each other directly for food, you can say, all right, well, there's no real protections for prairie dogs, but there are all these other species that might have protections that depend on prairie dogs. And so that's what we did when we were mounting the initial litigation. So we had state claims, we had municipal claims. There's consideration for wildlife in the municipal code that Castle Rock requires. And then there are other claims that you can put forth. At the same time as this was happening, we were also mounting a corporate responsibility campaign. And so again, one of the things that a commercial real estate developer wants when it comes to retail is the ability to market that ground. And so when you have one of these giant developments, what the market does, or standard market does, is they have what they call anchor tenants, and they want to get anchor tenants in their development because then smaller level tenants will come. And so we mounted a corporate responsibility. We got all the users on Facebook, all the users on the email lists, and others to really promote the call Costco, tell them not to lease on this landscape, call Whole Foods not to lease on this landscape. And when you target an anchor tenant and you're successful at leveraging that, you're going to get bad PR because there's social or environmental irresponsibility happening here, and you shouldn't be associated with that. You flood their lines with that bad PR and that threat of bad PR, which has also helped with the media exposure that's happening. And you push away the anchor tenants, and then all the smaller, like Tokyo Joe's, or which actually didn't, but a lot of the smaller retailers that require, so the way that it works is when they're leasing these out, a lot of the smaller retailers won't, as part of their contract, they won't show up unless there's a Costco or a Whole Foods or a Sam's Club. And so by targeting the anchor and pushing them off, you're utilizing a great deal of economic leverage toward that corporate responsibility campaign. And you're communicating to the developer that, look, economically, it's more valuable for you to work with us here and do the right thing by waiting on the development and relocating the prairie dogs at a later time, at a biologically viable time. So you've got the lawsuit, which with the burrowing owl claims and other wildlife claims. You've got the corporate responsibility campaign at the same time. You've got a, you know, the lawsuit helps because you can, there's that time frame, it was March 15th, mm-hmm. where the burrowing owl, it's an arbitrary time frame. So if there's a burrowing owl, and you get to snap a photo of a burrowing owl on the landscape at issue, that'll halt construction, right? And so, and then March 15th, they didn't, you know, if you're going to do it after March 15th, then that's typically when biologists say that burrowing owl will start coming through the area, and so they need to do a survey. And so they really needed to get all those burrows sealed before March 15th, otherwise that would prompt a burrowing owl survey. And if burrowing owl were found, then it halts it, right? And so getting that restraining order or the temporary restraining order injunction in the court, that motion filed, while the corporate responsibility campaign is happening, while people are protesting on the site, all of these things are happening at the same time. Different mechanisms of involvement, public involvement, law, media, and then even utilizing the corporate responsibility campaign or the economic leverage at the same time is really important, so that if one starts to atrophy, you can really pivot your resource and your energy into another one that tends to be more effective. And so having all of, you know, the feelers out there and then which one works, go with that, but still have the others on the burner just in case something happens, like what happened here, which is we got concessions with the lawsuit. They didn't want the judge to issue a temporary restraining order, so they said, we'll pony up money and settle the lawsuit out. We'll pony up money to have a translocation occur right now, which we were kind of like iffy about because it was still before, you know, talking about the biological, they were pregnant. There are all these issues, but they were popping fumatoxin tabs into the burrows at that time. We were able to get them to stop that, and then settle out to, you know, translocate a number of the prairie dogs, but at least stop the extermination while it was underway. And then have these other, they tried to get us to settle all fronts at the same time, and we said no. But, you know, and then the citizen involvement and the engagement at the town council, you know, one of the best ways to get people actively involved in a campaign is to put them in front of a forum that's supposed to be responsive to them, and then to watch that forum not be responsive to them. It galvanizes people. It gets them angry. Here's a democratic process where some of the most inspirational testimony I've ever seen regarding ecological values, children walked in and said, we are the future. We want, you know, we want to protect our wildlife and our natural environment, you know, wait on the development. And the town council just ignored them. And that was very upsetting to a great many people. So, you know, mounting any number of different fronts, so that if you get a wind from somewhere, if you get a national publication, suddenly you've energized one aspect of it. Or if you have a lawsuit that's happening. And all of them fuel each other as well. So while you're doing this media campaign, you're not just asking the media to show up and cover it because it's an important issue. You're giving them little nuggets of parts of the story that are developing always. So here's what's happening with this development. It's going to kill these prairie dogs. The people love these prairie dogs. Now we've got a protest. That's another reason for the media to show up. Oh, we filed a lawsuit. You issue a press release with the lawsuit. Oh, they filed a petition. The story keeps going and going and going, and there are points of the story that you can issue those press releases or contact the press to show up to do a story about this aspect of the ongoing campaign concurrently, to keep it energized and to keep attention on the issue. So those are all considerations that were happening concurrently as it was underway.
Can you talk a little bit more about what was actually happening to the prairie dogs during this time? One of you mentioned fumitoxin. Maybe you could expand on that.
Yeah, and I mean, you were there witnessing it. You should talk about that too, because it was really, I had received a restraining order right before they dropped the pellets, so we were out there monitoring the site all the time. We knew it was going to be that week because it was the opening of good weather right before the 15th. They started on March 10th. So we were waiting and knew that it was going to happen probably that day, so we were all watching the site. We were always out there, and of course they pulled up, and we saw them and chased them over to the Lowe's parking lot, confronted them. Then the police came up and handed me restraining papers, told me I needed to be 200 yards away from the whole site. And then they just started walking in probably about 5 minutes after they kicked me off the site and started dropping pellets down their burrows. And there was I put out an emergency call. I don't know, that first day maybe 30 to 50 people showed and stayed there. And Fox News came and did a pretty extensive film on, or they did some really good coverage on the whole poisoning. And that really helped enrage and upset people quite a bit.
What does the fumitoxin do?
The fumitoxin, it's a terrible poison, and basically they put it in the burrows, then they put some water on it, put newspaper down, and it gases out and it causes them to bleed from internally for 2 to 7 days. And they just pretty much slowly die out, bleeding out of all the orifices of their body. And lots of them were crawling back up and dying on surface. So people were seeing that. They also, when they were on the site for those 3 days, 3.5 days, they were witnessing all the bunnies convulsing. We have film of that and dying. Birds, red-winged blackbirds, they have several different birds in the freezer still. And somebody saw ravens drop dead out of the sky. And, of course, the whole time the USDA is supposed to be in charge of that, and they were like, oh, nothing would ever die but the prairie dogs. And here we have all these animals dead right there in the film of it, and people going in the hospital from the fume toxin, kids who are kneeling right next to the burrows trying to protect the prairie dogs and then just dropping it right in front of their faces. I mean, they were 13-year-olds. And younger kids too. So it was a pretty horrific ordeal for the people who were there.
So where were the police all this time?
The police were on the site protecting the people dropping the fume toxin from the protesters. And the protesters continually went up to them and asked why they weren't trying to protect them from the poisons. They were not there to protect them. They were there to protect the animal and pest control company. So and then we tried all angles of that. Brian worked on a long-ass document that night, the first night they started dropping it, on how they, on the poison and the illegality of that. And they didn't do much,
raises a good question, though. You've got the poisons being spread in a relatively public area, at least at the time. You've got the prairie dogs being exterminated. What kind of reaction did you get from government officials who may or may not have been responsible for either the public safety or wildlife safety?
They said it was completely out of their hands. It wasn't their issue. It was the Department of Agriculture's issue, right?
The Colorado Department of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. So what happens is that fumitoxin is a heavily regulated chemical. It's aluminum phosphide, which turns into phosphine gas when it combines with the moisture in the air. Heavily regulated, federal and state law requires that you abide by the instructions on the label. Many of the instructions are to post signage as to what you're using, that it's being applied in a given area. The Animal Pest Control Specialists, is that the name of the exterminating company?
Yep.
They failed to post signs. They failed to respond to protesters who were protesting at the site, their inquiries as to what they were using. And then, like you said, in direct proximity, they were dropping the tabs. It was a horrible, flagrant disregard and I would say a belligerent application of a really horrible chemical at a landscape level. So I argued with the CDA, the Colorado Department of Agriculture, and the EPA, who are still ongoing investigations are underway. But, you know, even if the label were followed, this was a, you know, a huge landscape scale application, which typically isn't anticipated with the label. And clearly the mass application of fumitoxin was having consequences. So with that petition, we were concerned about a number of children that were exposed to fumitoxin and later medically treated. Adults that were exposed to fumitoxin, and then obviously the animals that were killed during the exposure of fumitoxin, including migrating birds. The Migratory Bird Treaty Act proscribes the killing of those birds, and they died. The police maintained that it wasn't their jurisdiction to enforce apparently state law. Totally not true. The CDA took a hands-off approach. A lot of times these agencies, like the Colorado Department of Agriculture, are really captured by agricultural interests, and so they're really pro-use. So fumitoxin, the EPA normally regulates that. They had delegated that to the state bodies. There's rules delegating jurisdiction over the regulation of these chemicals and to state bodies. And so the state really didn't know what to do. They were largely unresponsive and claim that an investigation is currently underway, but we'll see. So it was a horrific situation.
Okay. It sounds like there's three collective parties involved in this whole scenario. There's the developer, there's the town council / local government, and then there's the activists. How would you describe the relationship among those three parties? Broad terms.
I mean.
So, for example, what do you think the relationship was between the developers and the town council?
Oh, yeah. The developer and the town council were definitely working together. It was important for both of them to get this project underway just because of the money involved. And so, of course, they're. Whatever, you know, they had economic interests on both sides to really get this pushed through. And the activists were just there pretty much to expose that connection and to try to show the corrupt nature of that merger of the corporation with the state or with the town, with the government officials. You know, I think the same was true even with when you start getting into it, just with the poison and everything like that. They're definitely protecting the moneyed interests and not the people. Not the activists. So the activists, you know, relationship really is to expose that as an issue and a problem and try to do what we can using the tools that we have to, you know, try to stop that from happening. And, I mean, like, continuing that too with the poison for sure. I know Wildlands Defense is really getting into exposing all the different kinds of poisons that they use on these prairie dogs and the effects that they have on this wide, you know, landscapes with all the other animals that come into contact with it, not just the prairie dogs and us too, humans. Anytime you use large amounts of poison, it's going to come around and it's not going to be good for any living being.
So how would you characterize this group of activists that you were involved with? I know they've sometimes gone by the name Prairie Dog Liberation Front, and that doesn't necessarily include everybody that was involved, but that seemed to be kind of a core group of activists. Mm-hmm. What was this group like?
I think the activists that we were mostly brought together, I mean, that's like what any group of activists is like. It's all a wide range of people with different philosophies, different beliefs. But everybody did come together over a concern of the prairie dogs. And some people were involved because they liked drama. Some people were involved because they wanted to do something. Some people were involved because they really cared about wildlife. And then there were, you know, other people got involved because they were concerned about growth. Lots of people didn't want the mall at all, and lots of people got involved and didn't know anything about prairie dogs and started to learn about that and started to think, well, that's not right. So it was just a wide group of people coming together who wanted to help change the situation that we saw out there. And yeah, I mean, it was a lesson for me as an organizer on the ground, just of how difficult it is when you have interpersonal relationships involved in a group like this of people coming from such different backgrounds. Lots of people in Castle Rock are very conservative and just trying to work around, not radical. They don't understand the roots of the problems. I'd say the majority of the group did not and still does not understand a systemic problem, and they just have very narrow focus on what they were fighting for. And it just, it was a good, I guess, learning experience for me and for everybody else involved of just how difficult activism can be when interpersonal dynamics come into play.
Okay. It is, I think, commonly accepted that you're one of the leaders of this group, and we net been accusatory sense. But what do you see, if you could expand on that just for a minute, what do you see as some of the challenges associated with working with a group like that?
Well, I mean, it depends all on the different parts of the campaign and what stages you're at. I mean, when we were doing all the, when everybody was trying to protect the prairie dogs, it's very enticing and it's a very meaningful thing, and people were extremely good at it. I mean, we had a 24-hour patrol. People were always there for the 2 hours and in contact and saying what was going on. And that was, everybody was really involved in that piece. And then as it went on and we started doing more things like the referendum and the political stuff, it became more difficult to keep everybody together and focused on those issues and to continue driving the campaign through. I also think we had an advantage because people did see and witness those animals die, and so that they were really willing to do something and to really take it an extra step because they wanted to see some kind of action taken against the developers and the town council to show them that that was not going to be accepted. And it did make us really bond together. I mean, I was getting on conference calls, we had between 20 and 25 people every single night for quite some time, for a couple months at least. And that's pretty incredible on conference calls, and it's also difficult. But, I mean, people were very involved, very concerned, and very driven to do what was right. And then it just kind of started falling off the more work that was involved in actually standing on the street, because it's never fun. And then, of course, we had challenges. I had challenges recently when we decided to take certain steps with the referendum.
Would you like to expand on that?
Can we back up? Can you continue the story from you settled on part of it to stop them from the Puma toxin dropping and get a translocator in there? What happened after that?
Yeah, this is it. So much happened during that. But, so then that was mainly the lawsuit. We were able to bargain and try to get these prairie dogs relocated, and a group of people came in to do that. The problem with relocating prairie dogs in Colorado and other states is that they don't typically relocate prairie dogs, and you can't find land to put them on, and then they make these really, especially in Colorado, county-to-county regulations, so that it's damn near impossible to even move a prairie dog colony from one county to another because you have to have commissioner's approval. That law was put in place in the 90s. And it's a really nightmare situation, but the people who came in said, we've got permits. We're going to move them to New Mexico, to a very large ranch, a very large landholder. And it turned out that after the prairie dogs were in limbo for several weeks, that they did not have the permit to do this in New Mexico. So we had all these prairie dogs in limbo. And so they had been sitting in tanks for 3 weeks at that point. They didn't get in the ground until 4 weeks later, so these poor prairie dogs were in actual water trough tanks, silver tanks, and who knows where they were. And it turned out being a very bad situation. And we were really upset because that's not what we were told was going to happen. So we had to really push on that front, too, to get these prairie dogs up here where I live in an area where prairie dogs are not, where the blacktail prairie dogs are not typically, they have never been up here on this kind of land at this elevation. So we pushed really, really very hard. Got the governor involved, litigation. My mom was very upset because they wouldn't let them come up here, and they were going to kill them all and give them to a raptor program to feed all the birds. So we worked on that and actually ended up miraculously getting Colorado Parks and Wildlife to agree to this land because of all the pressure. Fox News got involved again. governor, the litigation, everything that went in, all the different angles again, pushing on them to get them approved. So then they did end up coming up here. And then we went back, and at that point we were getting signatures for the referendum. We started doing that third day of the poisoning, or second day of the poisoning. So we had all these different things going on. So the referendum basically was telling the council, hey, you approved zoning twice, you didn't care, you didn't listen to what we have to say, so now we're going to put this up for a vote. Or we're going to try to anyway, by gathering signatures. So we went out on the streets and started doing that, and the Prairie Dog relocation did happen in that time, and we just worked really hard to get those signatures up because we knew that that was going to keep those Prairie Dogs alive on the site. That became our leverage, and the main leverage with the developer was that referendum, because he couldn't continue with construction now until that referendum. Well, still he can't continue with construction now until the Prairie Dogs are relocated, because that's part of the deal, but the referendum kind of held off on the construction of the majority of the site. And so we used that as leverage to save the rest of the Prairie Dogs and to also set an example for future developers not to do this and to deal with activists on the front end and relocate the Prairie Dogs before they find themselves in a situation of similar magnitude and
financial loss. Did you get enough signatures on the referendum?
Yeah, we ended up collecting over what we needed, and then we kept that, the council then had to decide, and they had 3 weeks, 4 weeks, was it?
Yep.
To decide whether or not they wanted to rescind the ordinance, which means bring it back to the old zoning, and or to go ahead and put it up for a vote to the people. And the vote basically was on a zoning ordinance. So was the mall going to build on, was some light industrial involved, which is the old zoning, or do it 100% retail? So that was really what the vote would end up being, and we were hoping before that it would actually be able to stop the mall, because the developers would see it as such a huge financial loss if they had to go back to the old zoning that they would just throw up their hands. But they were already so far into it that that was not going to happen, and if they had to build on the old zoning, they would have. So, and the old zoning really wasn't going to affect too much of what they wanted to do in the first place. So they would just continue, but they would have preferred the new zoning, because they already had quite a bit of money and a development plan in place, which they would have had to redo if they're going to do the old zoning, blah, blah, blah. So then we got up to that point where when the council was going to decide whether or not they were going to rescind the ordinance or put it up for a vote, which most likely they would have rescinded it, put it back to the old zoning so that they could just get this all over with and continue with the construction. The petitioners decided to, and the Alberta Development came up with an agreement so that we could just, you know, put in some pretty serious and positive protections for wildlife in exchange for just allowing them to continue with their new zoning plan.
Can you share any of the details of this agreement?
No.
Okay.
So, essentially what you're dealing with when you're dealing with a referendum is, in the state of Colorado and in many states, they have what they call home rule. Namely, that any ordinance change or any substantive ordinance change that goes into effect by a town council or a county commission, there are 30 days with which the citizens can gather enough signatures to challenge the issuance of that zoning change or of that ordinance. Very democratic thing. What that does is if you gather sufficient signatures, which different counties and different municipalities have different requirements for the number of signatures given the electors in each jurisdiction, then the town council chooses whether or not to rescind it of their own accord or to put it to a referendum of an election. And so this mechanism was very powerful in a number of ways with respect to a campaign. It continued to elevate the media element And again, remember the valuation of the retail development. If you're a retailer, you want to be able to sell your property. You want it to have positive PR. And so all of these are opportunities to scrutinize an aspect of the development in a way that had tangible market consequence, given the controversy. And so the referendum, pushing forth the referendum, continuing to halt, because at the time, after all was said and done with the litigation settlement, which was supposed to provide for the translocation of the prairie dogs, but which did not provide for the translocation of the prairie dogs because of any number of circumstances surrounding that, there were still many prairie dogs left on site. And so are they just going to bulldoze over it? Are they going to continue a poison scheme? Are they going, what are they going to do? We didn't know whether the bulldozers were going to start gearing up. But we did know we had this democratic mechanism where if they started those bulldozers, that was going to punch them at the ballot, right? And so when you have that mechanism hanging over their head, it blows energy into their incentive not to do something controversial for fear that the voters will respond or the community will respond in a disfavorable way. And so there's a great deal of value associated with that signature petition effort. And it held the pressure over the head, kept the limelight with respect to the prairie dogs that were still remaining on site. And it's very fascinating because, you know, this isn't conceivable. It's inconceivable in a lot of ways that $177 million real estate development would halt for 6 months and not move forward to accommodate the well-being of a community of prairie dogs. That's inconceivable. But it happened. And that's, you know, when Deanna and the citizens of Castle Rock and other residents of Colorado testified, they had one ask, and that was, wait to accommodate a viable, biologically sound translocation of these prairie dogs. And everybody said it couldn't be done, it was impossible, it wouldn't be done, it doesn't math out or whatever, it doesn't make economic sense. And the referendum, the litigation, the media, the corporate responsibility campaign, the bad PR, all of it changed to where now it was economically prudent to accommodate the well-being of the prairie dogs. And that's a magical thing. I think that's a pretty significant thing when you think about how large this economic behemoth is and how they typically do it without consideration for such things at all.
How many prairie dogs were out there initially, and then plus what was the significance of this colony? I mean, is it the only one, or are there lots of others around, or compared to other?
From what I know from talking with the Prairie Dog Coalition, when I first called them, they said there was up to 8,000 burrows at first, then they dropped that way down. Alberta had a couple different things, so then they came back and said, oh, there's only a couple thousand. But the whole point of it was one of the largest ones that were still intact along the Colorado's Front Range. So there are very few prairie dog colonies of that size left in Colorado along this Front Range. Now, way east on the prairies and stuff, I'm not sure if there probably are larger prairie dog colonies out there, but in this area where there used to be every single area of prairie land covered with prairie dogs, they are down to less than 1% of their original habitat, and that's all over the west they are. But even so here along the Front Range. So it was one right now in Douglas County. There's one other prairie dog colony that's pretty large. The rest of them have all been killed, and that one that's pretty large, just got a phone call from the developer there. They are putting 948 homes on top of that and two golf courses. And they just routinely, and then just a few weeks ago, they another very large prairie dog colony, a little bit smaller than the second one I'm looking at, was they dropped fumitoxin and killed over half of that prairie dog, more than half of that prairie dog colony. It was the only one left on that road from here to 40 miles away. The only one left. And they pretty much had killed that one off. Yeah, it's just the, on that site there, I would guess, because I think there's about 5% were left or less of the survivors, and there's about, there was about 300, we're guessing about 375 survivors were the ones that were brought here. And, you know, there could be more. But, so the, it, take that into account and consider that it was probably less than 5% of what was on that colony. I'd say they killed between, I think they killed 2,000 to 4,000 prairie dogs. And it's hard to say because all these prairie dogs, they were everywhere on the landscape, everywhere. And then after they've dropped the fumitoxin and you go in, now they are not anywhere. I mean, you see them in little pockets here and there where the relocators know they are, but they're certainly, they were hit really hard and most of them were killed.
So would you characterize this whole incident as a success or a failure or something else?
Can I ask to kind of encapsulate or get a big picture view? So your initial goal was just to postpone development long enough to successfully translocate the prairie dogs.
Yes.
When the developers and the council refused to give any thought to that, your goal was to still try to achieve that or save as many prairie dogs from extermination as possible and to inflict economic damage on the developer to show that it would have been in his best interest and for future developers it would be in their best interest to go along with the initial demands rather than just blowing you off. And then your strategies that you brought to bear as all this progressed were media coverage, public opinion, the legal and economic fronts. Is that pretty good summaries or anything?
Right. Well, and I think the most important thing to me for the whole campaign and probably for Wildlands Fence or anybody who cares too is to really shine light on this whole problem. I mean, it's a total, you know, Holocaust, genocide, whatever, of prairie dogs, very and of everything in the world we can see in tying in together the loss of these last very small remnants of prairies and everything that lives on those prairies. And, you know, getting people to realize the significance of this, because everybody here in Colorado generally at the start of this campaign, and lots of people have definitely changed their mind, but they see prairie dogs as plague-ridden rodents who are no good for nothing, break everybody's horses' legs, disgusting, gross, vile creatures, and that has changed with a lot of people, where people are actually thinking, I mean, still a lot of people hate the prairie dogs because, I mean, they don't, they're very uneducated and have heard lie after lie after lie by, you know, rumors and myths that have been started by the ranching industry to get rid of the prairie dogs off the land, but and off the landscape. But I think that this has brought a lot of light onto that, and people thinking, like, lots of people come to me and say, oh my gosh, there's less than 1% of their habitat left, and they find that really shocking and upsetting. And then just seeing them, like, they're charismatic creatures, and seeing the pictures, and after actually looking and thinking about these animals and going, wow, they're really beautiful. And lots of people stopping then at the promenade site and looking at these animals and realizing that, wow, this is a significant colony sitting here. I never even noticed it before. So it brought, that of course is what all the issues of the media and the economic punishment and how we can make changes that way, because we have to make changes, are hugely important. But the most important thing to me too is just, and that has to do with it, is to stop and get people to understand that this is just that the importance of our land and the loss and speed in which we're losing it. And, you know, what are we going to do? We need to radicalize people. We need to get people to do things much differently than we've done. The yoga and the praying and the whatever, the petitions and all that, it's not going to do a damn thing. You got to do something that's going to hurt these developers and killers or whatever you want to call them, profiteers. And we're getting to the end of our, you know, availability of anything viable or light living as we see on every aspect of the land everywhere.
So do you feel you had enough success with this to build on it with any other campaigns or developers? And yeah, where do you go from here?
You want to talk about what happened in Boulder?
Yeah, no, I mean, so, and to sort of dovetail what she was talking about, really it is the difference between liberal advocacy and radical advocacy. And radical advocacy, I think, objectively, is more effective. I don't think you can argue that liberal advocacy is more effective. And the reason for that is, as we saw, we had a lot of liberal advocates asking, please, and wanting to work with. And unless you demonstrate the conviction and the resolve, there's really no motivation for somebody to go along and incorporate your values into their situation. As far as springing it forth into ongoing campaigns, I think that one of the things I'd like to see is for, you know, what happened here to be known and anticipated in a market sense. So I'm not a capitalist, I think capitalism is wrong, yada yada yada. But the reality is that it's happening all over the place. And so how do we send a market message that very explicitly says, you know, maybe we should accommodate, you know, or consider the cost of doing the right thing for wildlife into the cost of doing business, so that, you know, ideally we'll be able to preserve prairies with prairie dogs. A prairie isn't a prairie without prairie dogs, in a lot of, right? That's the ideal. Short of that, there need to be greater considerations and greater concessions afforded to wildlife, because there's not enough left. And one of the ways that you can do that is really to demonstrate the public support, and that it's unpopular, both whether you're a consumer or a citizen or whatever. There's going to be a consequence to destroying life like this in such a wanton way. And so organizing that compassionate sentiment to create that condition, and exploring which ways work, which ways don't, were very important. As far as Boulder, we've seen consequences in a number of places in Colorado. One example is Boulder, where there was a county commission entertaining a want to do a revegetation plan. They had a prairie dog colony on that. They knew who we were, and they knew what was happening in Castle Rock and all the controversy that was happening. And that revegetation plan, which included the extermination of a colony of prairie dogs, was tabled when we made a phone call showing interest in why they were allowing an extermination of a prairie dog colony for a revegetation plan for a wild horse. It wasn't a wild horse, but it was a horse rescue sanctuary. So changing, you know, the way people consider the significance of prairie dogs can happen. And if you create an unfettered, stinky disaster in Castle Rock, people are going to not want that where they are and with what they're doing. And so you have to be willing to lean into controversy and the radicalism in that sense.
Is the main difference that you see between liberal advocacy and radical that the liberal strategy tends to just ask nicely, and the radical strategy backs it up with threats of force and then actual force when if the petitionee say no? So in this example, rather than just circulating a petition that said, please don't kill the prairie dogs, you use that to use the contacts of people on that list to then make phone calls and get some of the major anchors to back out and also proceed with the lawsuit and the other strategies. So is that the main difference, the use of force versus just asking?
I'd say, yeah, adversarialism, a willingness to lean into adversarialism might be the better word, versus collaboration, but really enfranchising the compassionate voice into tangible action that has consequences, and being okay with those consequences being painful to the adversary. A lot of what you see in advocacy nowadays is a not want to be controversial, or a not want to be seen as negative, or an aversion to political controversy, not partisan politics, but to being called negative or radical, or, you know, as if radical is a pejorative word, which it's not. But it's really, for me, it's really that the issue here is the well-being of the prairie dogs, not my vanity, right? Or not my organizational expediency, or not my want to collaborate and believe that we can kumbaya our way into a better world. Because it's not effective. And unfortunately, I mean, it is effective in certain contexts. If it's, you know, respected and there's solidarity and that pluralism associated with the environmental movement is very effective in a lot of ways when it can be. It can also tear us apart at the seams. But combative advocacy, I think, is really important. And I think it's important that these things mean enough to us that we're willing to lean into the controversy. And we have to show that. And so that's, you know, that's where I'd go with, you know, radical advocacy versus liberal advocacy. Liberals would more rely on, because what we did was technically liberal, right? Lawsuits, democratic processes, right? Within the system. But at the same time, I would say that adversarial and that willingness to really get in their face and inflict, you know, damage is the difference.
Like you were saying too, I mean, getting involved in the political system, because that's where you're going to be able to, you know, create that damage. You were talking a lot about that. I mean, we were talking like Clive and Bundy or whatever, which were, I mean, they get in these people's faces and they fight and they get what they want because of that. And if everybody just sits back and, okay, well, I guess you can't, which is what's happened with prairie dog, one prairie dog colony after another, because there are always advocates for prairie dogs. And they just end up saying, well, let's just get some money then from you so that maybe we can buy some land and maybe we can put some other prairie dogs in danger some other time down on the land that we might. I mean, that's been the solution. Like, oh, well, they're not going to do anything. That's what everybody told me from the start, except for you. Except, you know, you're not going to get anything out of this. They're going to kill all the prairie dogs. You may as well try to get some money out of it so that we can buy, so that these other organizations, so that we, Humane Society, Southern Plains Land Trust, can buy land so that we can save prairie dogs in the future, because the problem really is the land. No, the problem really is developers get away with killing prairie dogs. That's the problem. And so what do we do to make it so they don't get away with doing that? And then you have to get involved in just what we did, where you make it painful on them through the political system or whatever leverage you have to actually force them to do something, because they're going to have a loss if they don't.
And I wouldn't mind, you know, it doesn't need to be political. It doesn't need to be just enforcement of the rule of law. It doesn't, you know, it can be civil disobedience. I mean, there were moments, you know, she stomped on the traps. Like, people are compelled by conscience to do what it takes. That's, you know, that's wonderful. But there, the real question is whether or not you understand the language that will compel them to comport their behavior to that of being less willing to destroy life. And you do that through cost when it comes to a capitalist. And so all of these things, whether they're liberal or radical, can be leveraged to communicate or send that message in different ways. And oftentimes when it comes to cost, it's very effective, you know, to halt the development. I mean, how many days, how much money is lost with each day, how much, the same with the referendum. Once you get that sufficiency, they can't carve up the land again. It's a couple of months at least, or a few months, 5 months of just no development. That's a problem for them. That sends the message. And that's, you know, 5 months of no rent. That's a big deal. And that communicates better than any of our ideology ever would to people that aren't coming from the same place that we are. So, different ways of doing that.
Any final comments for us? I think we're out of questions.
Yeah, I just think that stuff like this too, in any campaign, because everybody, I mean, we always think about what can we do as activists to stop the destruction of the land or destruction of our planet. And I think, like, right now, we just started. I mean, we have to go now and do this to save several different more colonies that are under the gun before people are going to start stepping back and saying, maybe I don't want to buy that land if it has prairie dogs on it. But that can happen if you sustain. I think it's just an important idea to continually sustain what you're doing and not just say, woo, yeah, got it done. Okay, now I'm going to go back because we really haven't done our work yet. And I think that that's a thing too. And then when people are concerned, like any activists, especially in our circle of DGR, wildlife defense or whatever, if we care about something, what are we going to do to make it to change and to make an effective campaign? How can we do that? And to start thinking along those lines where it is more radical and we're actually thinking about how are we going to actually hurt these people and make them take this into consideration.
I think it's important to have victories, even when they're on the local landscape scale, that you can demonstrate and demystify the notion of environmental advocacy being impossible. One of the biggest things, I've worked in the environmental community for 10 years with regional groups. I've worked in coalition with a lot of the national groups. I'm the chair of the grazing committee of the Sierra Club, right? So I work in and out of a lot of organizations that I think are even chicken shit. The biggest encumbrance, the biggest problem is this overwhelming notion of we can't do it, or we know better than to do it. Because environmentalists are some of the most brilliant people I've ever met. They have incredible minds, environmental lawyers, environmental, you know, theorists, environmental economists, environmental whatever. They have brilliant minds, but they're all using those minds to generate elaborate notions of knowing better why not to take direct action. I mean, it's right there. You know, and oh, if I do that, that'll be a political liability and hinder my ability in the future to do something bigger. And I just need to be on the next rung higher, the next rung higher, the next rung higher before I take my radical leap, right? I need to ascend that. And it's just not true. And it's right there. And taking action. I mean, when she stomped on that galvanized a lot of people. It was inspiration, and, you know, that's what I, you know, see from this as an example of how there's a local issue and you can really sink your teeth into it and make something that was supposed to not happen, happen in a meaningful way against a very powerful adversary. So, you know, there's a huge problem with prairie dog eradication. They're poisoning them in mass all over the place. The government is doing it with wildlife services. Ranchers are doing it. Land development is doing it. There need to be changes. There are effective handles and hooks that we can grab hold of to slow that down. And that exists with any number of other landscapes and exploitative industries as well. But I think the biggest and most interesting thing that I've learned, the most disheartening thing that I've seen really is all the reasons why, like, the thing right in front of you to do, how how people convince themselves, like, not to do it. Because there's something, I guess there's some ambition in the future. And, you know, so I hope people take direct action more, whether radical, liberal, whatever.
So if an ordinary citizen has something happening at their local level, and they're like Deanna, jump on it and get a few other people locally to start with them. Brian, you're available to consult or possibly look at issues. And then I'm also curious, Brian, like, are you an organization of 100 people and all these lawyers and powerhouses, or what kind of extra force did you bring? Like, how feasible is it for one person to start a campaign and get some outside help? What sort of resources were in this campaign?
Sure. So, I mean, I know a lot of lawyers, and I have friends that are journalists, and yeah, I mean, there are resources there. If there's a campaign that's there where there's life and it's imperiled and there's a willingness to engage, then that's what we do at Wildlands Defense. Is we provide the resources to enfranchise and otherwise empower the activists on the ground to do that, including consultation. But that want is the key thing. There's no energy without it. I mean, if she hadn't have, you know, there wouldn't be the organizational support for Deanna had she not really done the things that were asked and necessary, such as put voice to this life that's on the land in a meaningful way. And so I think there are a lot of people out there, and there are a lot of brilliant people and a lot of brilliant resources out there that want to do that. And they want to invest in their time or their energy or whatever they have into those kinds of things. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't think that I can't is ever an excuse not to, you know what I mean? And so, and I think it comes together if you reach out.
I agree. And it's just having that passion and care and putting it to action. It wasn't easy. That was we put a lot of time and hour and heart and passion and everything else into this. And it's just the willingness to be able to do that. That really needs to happen a lot more with lots of different people who really care.
Well, thanks for your time and your energy and your passion and your wisdom. I hope that a lot of people get to hear what you had to say today.
And you're doing awesome.
Thanks.